The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show, here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please, send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Guest today, Tavis Smiley, is in the house, and he has written The Rich and the Rest of Us with the indomitable Dr. Cornel West. And Tavis, welcome back to Baltimore, brother. Good to have you here.
Mark, good to see you. Glad to be back. Let me start by saying Dr. West sends his regards. We are on a three-week book tour, and this is the only day that we had to split. I got the long straw. I get to go to Baltimore, which I love.
And where did he go?
Columbus, Ohio.
You got the long straw.
I got the long straw. But he sends his, he said, you tell Brother Mark. I said hello and all the good people of Baltimore. How disappointed I am. This is the one stop on the tour that I can't make. But we'll connect again in New York tomorrow. We're doing Colbert tomorrow night.
So. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That should be funny.
Yeah, it should be fun.
You're time enough for Colbert.
Yeah, I've never done Colbert before.
You never have?
Doc has done him any number of times. And I've just kind of refused because I'm just not I'm not sure the format works for me. But I'm going to hold on to Dr. West real tight tomorrow night and let him navigate me through this Colbert moment. But it's been a great tour so far, and we couldn't, of course, as you know, I'd never go on tour for anything without coming to Baltimore. So I'm just honored to be back at my favorite library in the entire world.
So The Rich and the Rest of Us. Now, Tavis, you have been preaching this in many ways for a long time, mm-hmm. that this is the issue about poverty we can't let go.
Mm-hmm.
This is the number one issue in America,
mm-hmm.
but no one's paying attention to it.
Not enough. Doc and I argue in this new book, Mark, that poverty is the moral, the spiritual issue of our time. Put another way, poverty threatens our democracy. Poverty is a matter of national security, and I hope that by framing it in those terms, that we can get a real conversation. As you know, we haven't had a sustained conversation about poverty in this country from the top down since Johnson's war on poverty.
Right.
That's a long time,
right.
And that's a lot of Democrat and Republican presence in the meantime. So the bottom line is there, at least to us, appears to be a bipartisan consensus in Washington that poverty just doesn't matter, that the poor are not a priority.
So let me ask this. The number of things on our Facebook, when we put this out today that you were coming on, there were a body, not a majority, not even a huge minority, but a body of people, especially in the African-American community, who said, look, ask Tavis why he's always on Barack Obama's case.
Sure.
Is it just because he didn't show up at his forum? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's all in the face. They want to, so, and why is he? And I think this is an important thing to lay out there.
Sure.
Not as if you're like anti-Obama. You have, go ahead, you say it.
First of all, Dr. West and I have a very simple rule when it comes to Barack Obama and any other president for that matter, but especially Barack Obama. We respect him, we protect him, but we believe in correcting him. Always we respect the president, and I have protected him against vicious, vulgar right-wing attacks. I was just on Piers Morgan last night defending Barack Obama against these ridiculous Ted Nugent comments. I do this all the time. I've defended him against Tea Party outburst and racist rhetoric and white supremacist rhetoric. So I'm always defending him when I think people are coming after him unfairly, when he ought to be protected. So you respect, you protect. But Barack Obama ain't Jesus. He does not walk on water. He is not perfect. And when he's wrong, he's got to be corrected. Great presidents aren't born. Great presidents are made. They have to be pushed into their greatness. There is no Abraham Lincoln without Frederick Douglass pushing him. There is no FDR without A. Philip Randolph pushing him. There is no LBJ without MLK pushing him. So great presidents have to be pushed, and Doc and I believe in holding them accountable. And the last thing I'd say very quickly, since people keep asking this question 4 or 5 years later.
All the time.
The short answer is, because people don't want to do their homework, respectfully, This is my 20. I've been knowing you for most of these years.
Right.
This is my 20th year in the broadcast business. And for all those years, I've talked about accountability. So go back to my Tom Joyner commentaries. Go back to the 16 books I've written. Go back to my speeches. And the great thing about my career is it's all available because I've done it all in the public. It's all on TV. It's all on radio. It's all on the internet. You can do a little bit of research, just a little bit, and see how consistent I've tried to be to the truth. So when Bill Clinton was president, just a quick example, when Clinton's president, Mark, and everybody in black America is in love with Bill Clinton because he shows up and sings every verse to lift every voice and sing.
And plays the sax.
And plays the sax and all of that. And so we all love, we forget how much we love Bill, how much we love Bubba, because we now so much love Barack. But when we were in love with Bill Clinton, I was the guy on public, on Tom Joyner, on commercial radio, taking him to task when he did not go into Rwanda to stop that ethnic genocide. I took him to task. When he signed that ridiculous welfare deform, not reform, welfare deform bill 15 years ago, which now has women and children falling faster into poverty than any other group of Americans, I checked him and opposed him on the welfare bill. When he signed that racist, and I called it then, a racist crime bill, in Baltimore and any place else, you got to get right. caught with 100 times more powder cocaine than crack to get the same sentence. That's a racist law. I took Bill Clinton to task on that. When he sandbagged Lonnie Guinier at the Justice Department, I took him to task on that. I'm not going to spend all your time trying to remind people what I said about Bill Clinton. I have tried for the balance of my career to be consistent to the truth, to hold all leaders accountable to the best interest of our people. And when I think they're behaving cowardly, when I think they're pushing an agenda that is antithetical to the best interest of our people, I raise my voice. All these years, I've been celebrated for that. And when Obama shows up, now I'm a hater. Go figure.
So you do in this book, you lay part of the issue of poverty we're facing in America today, not all of it, part of it, as you just described, to Bill Clinton's welfare reformers. You put it in the book in here just now, deform.
Mm-hmm.
You put a lot of it right there.
There's no doubt about the fact that 15 years later, again, when a society allows its women and children, oftentimes the most weak and vulnerable, to fall faster into poverty than anybody else, it says something damning about our nation, Mark. When the fact of the matter is that the younger you are, I mean, listen to this now, the younger you are in America, the more likely you are to be poor. How do we abide that?
Right.
But that's the nation that we live in now. One out of two of us is either in or near poverty. 150 million Americans wrestling with poverty.
One out of two.
One out of two.
Right.
You can't sustain a democracy like that. So either we get serious about poverty or we ultimately lose our democracy. That's how serious this is. And that's why we say it's a matter of national security. So, again, this is not hyperbole. In the last race for the White House, since you raised Obama, here's some more facts. In the last race for the White House, in three presidential debates, the word poor or poverty didn't come up one time.
Right.
Obama didn't raise it. McCain didn't raise it. The moderators, Mark wouldn't have done this, Tabish wouldn't have done this. The moderators didn't even ask about it.
Right.
So the economy is tanking. No talk about the poor or poverty. Here's another fact for you. Pick up the new issue of Rolling Stone and read the damning article on how Barack Obama is dropping more drones on innocent and killing innocent women and children. We're up to over 800 now. Up to over 800 innocent women and children killed by the dropping of drones in Pakistan and other places. He has escalated those drones more than George Bush used those drones. It's his favorite weapon now. And how do we abide the belief in our community, the black community especially, that the president, as he stands for re-election, has to beat his chest and brag about killing people? About assassinating people? That's not part of the best of our tradition. And I understand that he's the president and he's caught in betwixt and between on some of these issues. I understand how he's, you know, constrained by the construct that he finds himself operating in as the president. But here's the bottom line. The best of our tradition, Mark, is the black prophetic tradition of speaking truth to power and to the powerless. King and Malcolm are quintessential examples of that black prophetic tradition. Something is wrong when that very tradition of telling the truth out of love and respect is on life support.
This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment. We're here with Tavis Smiley. His book is The Rich and the Rest of Us, a poverty manifesto that he wrote with Dr. Cornel West. Now, and the manifesto part's important.
Mm-hmm.
It's a play on many things when you write that. But we're talking about one of the things you'd call for in this manifesto is you want to see a White House conference called to address the issues of poverty.
A White House conference on the eradication
on
of
the
poverty.
Eradication
no,
of
you're
poverty.
Right. A White House conference on the eradication of poverty. We're doing that because when Barack Obama was elected first time, he brilliantly and rightly made as his first official act the signing of the Lilly Ledbetter Law,
right?
Making sure that women can be treated fairly and economically fairly, that is, in the workplace. And so I'm so delighted that he signed the Lilly Ledbetter Law. I'm not a woman, but I believe in justice and fairness. And we talk about fundamental fairness in this country in this book and why so much of that is lacking. So he gets elected. He signs Lilly Ledbetter as his first act. We're suggesting, calling for, in fact, that the first official act of the next president of these United States be an executive order calling for a White House conference on the eradication of poverty. You bring together all the poverty experts, and we create a bipartisan national plan for how we're going to reduce and eradicate poverty in this country. It's important to note that while poverty is not at the moment a priority in Washington, there are all kinds of plans, Mark, to reduce and eradicate poverty in this country. Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia has
right.
one.
Which you write about in the book.
Mary Mott Edelman at the Children's Defense Fund right. has one. Catholic Charities has one. Jim Wallace at Sojourners has one.
Right.
These plans to reduce and eradicate poverty in the country exist, but nobody since Johnson has been serious enough about this to call for a White House conference on the eradication of poverty, bring these experts together, and create a national plan that we can all buy into to reduce this. Nobody in America wants to be poor, and when half of us are wrestling with poverty, something has to be done, or as I said earlier, and Doc and I argue in the book, we lose our democracy. Other countries have done it. For example, Chile. Between 1987 and 2009, Chile, with a national plan, reduced poverty from almost 48% to about 11%. Hmm. After the war on poverty, we reduced poverty in this country during the Johnson years. So it can be done. Again, it's not a will problem. It's not a skill problem. It's a will problem. Do we have the will to get serious about reducing poverty?
Now, a couple of things. So I'm curious why you think it's so difficult to get this conversation started, why it's so difficult to get the new war on poverty beginning. Where do you see the problem?
Three quick answers. One, poor people oftentimes don't vote, and so they get written off. They get rendered invisible. They are an afterthought at best in a political election year. They're a political calculation. Number two, both parties are tied to big money. They're both tied to Wall Street. Mr. Romney, I just read the New York Times yesterday on a plane coming into Baltimore. Mr. Romney is expected to raise about $600 million in this campaign. Barack Obama last time raised $750.
Yes.
He wasn't the president and he raised $750. He didn't
right.
have the bully pulpit. So you add $600 million plus $750 million. I can't even count that high. But you add $600 million, $750 million. You're over $1 billion, obviously.
Right. Right.
That's what we're talking about on this campaign. And that doesn't include the millions more spent by the super PACs that I know you've talked about.
Right.
So what could be done with all of that money? Both parties are so beholden to big money and to Wall Street that poor people just aren't made a priority. Thirdly and finally, there are many reasons. I just want to give you three as
yeah.
to why we can't get traction on this. Because on K Street, there are 13,000 lobbyists. Take a guess how many of them represent poor people. You got Mary Wright Edelman, basically.
Exactly right.
And a couple other people, you know, who are talking about poor people. So the lobbyists really run Washington, and that's why we can't seem to get traction on these issues.
So one of the things you talk about here, and I think it's important, is you retrace Martin Luther King's steps.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Dr. West really look at Martin Luther King and Dr. King as the greatest American that ever lived.
That's
you said
right.
that more than once, and
mm-hmm.
so was he. So, and you trace those steps to Mississippi, Chicago, Appalachia, and Memphis. And for me, I love this part of the book because I'm a little older than you.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
So I was there in 68,
mm-hmm.
and I lived in Resurrection City.
In D.C.?
In D.C.
Wow.
And I worked for the Poor People's Campaign.
You were in Resurrection City?
Yeah, I lived in the Resurrection City.
I never knew that.
And I organized poor whites in Ohio and Appalachia to join the Resurrection City.
Wow.
Who flew the flag at Dixie in Resurrection City. But nobody cared because it was this unity among
sure.
all poor people.
Wow.
So something exploded then. So how do you see that exploding now? How do you see a movement beginning after all your travels, after all your conversations around the country? How do you see that bubbling up and happening in America today?
First of all, I've always loved you, as you know, and celebrated you. I had no idea your Resurrection City. We got to talk more about that off the air. I got to hear more about this.
Right.
The short answer is the Occupy movement is one of the ways forward. I'm glad the spring is here. I'm glad that they're going to come back in full force. They have given us the language. We talk in the book about the fact that so much of the language around poverty is bankrupt. What is a jobless recovery? What is minimum wage versus a living wage? What is the working poor? If you work, you ought not to be poor. Our language is so bankrupt around the conversation that I'm glad we now have the 99% and the 1%, which people can understand and wrap their brains around. And the polls and surveys and studies I've read and you've read suggest that most Americans agree with the motives and the mission of the Occupy movement. So that's one way forward. But at the end of the day, every one of us has agency. And we might not all be able to go sleep out on the sidewalk with Occupy like you did at Resurrection City, but every one of us has a voice. Every one of us has a vote. Every one of us can demand that Mr. Romney, the presumptive nominee from his party, and Mr. Obama get serious about discussing poverty and get serious about a plan to reduce and eradicate it. Every one of us does, in fact, have that kind of agency.
So when we look at what you write about here, there's so many interesting chapters in this book. Because you have the poverty of opportunity, the poverty of affirmation, the poverty of vision, imagination, courage. You really break it down in different levels that can be kind of grasped by people. Because what you're talking about here in many ways is the complexity of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we see it as America looks at poverty as a black thing.
It's color coded. Right? It's color coded.
It's color coded.
Mm-hmm. And it's not. On this tour we saw last summer. 11 states, 18 cities, we saw Americans of all races, all colors, all creeds, who are suffering with and struggling with poverty. So many millions more of Americans, Mark, are not even looking for work anymore, so you can't even believe these numbers. Some folk are suffering in silence because they're too embarrassed. What we found is that people are, by and large, beyond the embarrassment of having lost their home, lost their job, having been unemployed for some cases years. What people want to hold on to, though, is their dignity. And this is why poverty threatens your democracy. This is why poverty is a matter of national security. Because when you have half of your populace running around and they don't have anything to hang their hat on, and their dignity is threatened and their humanity is challenged, because I believe, as Dr. King believed and Dr. West and I believe, that there is dignity in work. There is dignity in labor. So how do you hold on to your dignity? How do you get people to revel in your uniqueness and your humanity? And how do you exercise your agency and your right to self-determination when you don't have an opportunity to use the God-given skill and talent that he has blessed you with? That's why we have got to get serious about eradicating this, because so many people are running around with nothing to believe in. And it's one thing to not be optimistic. It's quite different to not even have any reason to be hopeful. I'm a witness, I'm an example that you can build a whole life on hope, but even hope needs help. And so what Doc and I are trying to do to help Mr. Obama with his hope message is to get serious about talking about poverty.
Because even you, as you write about in the book, again, the very beginning of the book, and your different ways that you and Dr. West grew up, you grew up in a trailer, 13 people in that trailer.
That's right.
Nine brothers and sisters, if I remember right.
You got it right.
And
one bathroom.
And one bathroom. That's rough.
Yeah, exactly.
That's rough. Especially in the winter.
Got it.
But when you said you were built on hope, but it was hope and other things and people around you that got you through poverty into another place.
Mm-hmm.
We have this myth in this country of, it seems to me, of it's that the individual can do it all by him or herself.
That's right.
That they can do it by their own bootstraps and lift themselves up.
We argue in this book that every one of us is who we are because somebody loved us.
Right.
Somebody loved every one of us, and that's what helps make and create who we are as people, number one. And number two, we take to task this notion of American exceptionalism. You know, we can't continue beating our chest that we're the biggest, baddest, best thing in the world, that somehow God is smiling on us and frowning on everybody else in the world when half of our nation is wrestling with poverty. That's a major, major indictment on this nation. And so the bottom line is that we are a better nation. We can do better than this. Poverty has got to be a priority in this country. In this presidential election year, Dr. West and I unapologetically assert that we're going to do whatever we can with our small platform to try to push this issue higher up on the American agenda. Both parties have been bankrupt when it comes to being creative and imaginative, that is, about this particular issue. But the bottom line, again, I keep repeating, either you get serious about the reduction of poverty or ultimately, Mark, you lose your democracy. My read of history suggests to me that there is no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter or fail. Every empire eventually goes down. And I don't know if it's our arrogance, our hubris, our narcissism, our patriotism that is now morphed into nationalism. I don't know what it is that doesn't even allow us to consider how near the edge, how on the precipice we really are of our democracy collapsing if we don't get serious about this gap.
So before you have to run, because you're going to be at the Enoch Pratt at 7 o'clock. You got to get down there and get ready. By the folks, you can go to the Enoch Pratt Free Library on Cathedral Street this evening, 7 p.m. Tavis will be there talking about his book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, and you should join that. As a board member of the library and as a friend of Tavis, you should get down there and be part of that this evening. I won't be able to be there, so I'll be here working on the station, but you should get down there.
Yeah, you do your job.
I'll do my job.
Yeah, you do that, yeah.
So, but to close out here, so talk about the hope. Talk about what you read here and where the hope is that this can change, what that's based on.
Doc and I make this distinction in the book that you know well, Mark, between optimism and hope. Optimism suggests that there is a particular set of facts or circumstances, conditions, something that you can see, feel, or touch that gives you reason to believe that things are going to get better. That has never been the narrative inside of Black America, and it is now not the narrative for most Americans. Most Americans, or at least half of us right now, do not see anything in front of us that would suggest to us that we have reason to be optimistic. But hope is a very different thing. For all of my secularist friends and my atheistic friends and my agnostic friends, forgive me for just a moment as I go back to my Christian faith and remind you of one of my favorite scriptures in the Bible found in Hebrews, that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So that even when you don't have conditions that you can see, feel, or touch to give you reason to believe that things are going to get better, even when you can't say, I'm optimistic about my future, we at the very least ought to be able to hold on to some hope for the future. What's happened to America now is that people have even lost hope. And again, I don't know how you sustain a democracy where the citizenry has lost its hope. There was a study done about a year ago that found that the slight majority of Americans no longer believe that our best days as a nation are in front of us. Something is wrong, Mark, when half of the country believes that the best days of the nation are already behind it. And that's why we're talking about this issue now, because we love our country, we love our people, we love all of humanity, but Black people clearly are catching the most hell. And in some ways, we've been too deferential to the process. We've been too silent to the process. And there's nothing wrong with celebrating Barack Obama. Let me be clear. We voted for him the last time. Dr. West did 65 events for Barack Obama around the country. We voted for him last time. We're going to vote for him again. There is no doubt. So for all the persons who always get it twisted, let me be clear if I walk out of this studio. There is no comparison between Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney.
Amen.
Let us be clear on what the choice is for us. Having said that, the brother still respectfully and lovingly needs to be pushed on the things that matter, and poverty is the moral and the spiritual issue of our time. I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks for having me in.
Tavis Smiley, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show, here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. To hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows and find out information about our guests, the work they do, what they've been writing, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.